Welcome to Does the Team Think with Arthur Askey, Cyril Fletcher, Bob Monkhouse, and the man who hatched up the idea, Professor Jimmy Edwards. And now, team, here comes a question from Mrs. Molly Hegarty. Hello, Mrs. Hegarty. Welcome to the program. Let's hear your question.
Does the team agree with Omar Khayyam that the three things needed for a contented life are a loaf of bread, a glass of wine, and thou beside me in the wilderness?
Does the team agree with Omar Khayyam that the three things needed for a contented life are a loaf of bread, a flask of wine, and thou beside me in the wilderness?
You can't take a girl into the wilderness with a loaf of bread. I mean, a fella did take one out, and he had to promise her a lot of things. He said, I will give you diamonds. I will give you emeralds. I will give you rubies. Or is your price above rubies? And she said, I don't know. How much does ruby charge?
Jimmy Edwards.
Who was this Mrs. Omar Khayyam?
Mr. Omar
Khayyam. He's a film star, plays bridge, isn't he?
How do you know it's a mister? It doesn't say so in my question.
Well, let's ask the question. Mrs. Hegarty, was Omar Khayyam a mister or a missus?
I think he was a Turk.
Oh.
Answer the question, madam.
Let's assume that Omar Khayyam was a gent.
Oh, he was, because...
But he'd be Opar Khayyam.
His lady friend told Omar Khayyam, I know all your tricks, so don't try them. She said, I'll fight for my virtue. I might even hurt you, but thank God you're stronger than I am.
I think you wrote that, didn't you?
That's one of his best-known verses.
I don't know why he was mad enough to suggest that you could survive in the desert on a loaf of wine, a flask of woman and a bottle of... What is it? Wrong. Wait a minute. I don't understand it. This is a ridiculous question. Let's have the next one.
Oh, no. Be fair. I mean... Obviously, he couldn't take it out there without he had a tent or something, could he?
Oh.
Because, as you know, when an Arab makes love, it's intense.
I think you can bring the whole thing up to date. There is this little man, and he says to a very large waitress, bring me a cup of weak tea and two slices of burnt toast.
Jimmy.
And the waitress says, anything else? And he says, yes, nag me, I'm homesick.
Jimmy, could I ask you, of the three ingredients here, a loaf of bread, a flask of wine, and thou, which would you get rid of?
Get rid of?
Yes!
Oh, don't bother with the bread, it's fattening.
You're all making fun, and obviously it's meant to be terribly romantic. I mean, the fellow would be singing, Pale Hands I Love Beside the Shalimar. And the girl's thinking, Shall I, Ma? Thank you.
I can't help thinking, really, Mrs. Hegarty, this is a rotten proposition to put to a girl. I mean, to come to her with some dry bread and a bottle of Algerian red biddy and say, come into the wilderness. And I was trying to work out on paper here what, say, a lady in Cyril Fletcher's world would reply.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Ome, but if you don't mind, I'd rather stay at home. You'll not pack me up with your wine and bread. You take your mum's hot water pot instead. I know more generous men, dear, and I love them, so take your bread and wilderness and shove off.
I'd like to hear the original, Mrs. Hegarty.
The original Fletcher coming up.
I think this is a very old-fashioned saying, and that I think that it should be, to err is human, isn't it divine?
I used to recite a poem about being in the wilderness, about the foreign...
They're all doing poems.
About the foreign legion. You didn't invent poems.
No.
I was ahead of you. Yes, when I worked under the name of Longfellow. I'm the shortest Longfellow you've ever seen. But I was merely saying that at one time I used to do a recitation about the Foreign Legion, and there was a line in it said, it's a hell of a life in the desert. It isn't so hard to detect it, for I'd send in my nostrils and send in my ears and send where you'd never expect it.
It's amazing what means happiness to the rest of this panel. To me, happiness is bumping into Sophia Loren very slowly indeed. Or possibly happiness is finding the owner of a lost bikini.
Thank you very much, team, and thank you, Mrs. Hegarty. Mr. John Gregory has taken his seat on my right-hand side. He now puts his question. This is it.
Does the team think that more comforts and gadgets should be provided in modern motor cars? And if so, what would they suggest?
Does the team think that more comforts and gadgets should be provided in modern cars? And if so, what would they suggest?
There should be a speedometer which is thrown onto the windscreen. I don't mean... thrown onto the windscreen. Our speed should be visible in a manner which is thrown onto the windscreen so that you don't have to take your eyes off the road to see how fast you're going.
What a great idea.
I mean, if you time the amount of time it takes to glance down at your speed and back again, you could have killed 80 nuns.
He could wear headphones to tell you the speed. It doesn't have to be a visual impression. I mean, you could have music played according to what speed you were going. You know, like, there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight when you get to 40 miles an hour. And when you get to 60 miles an hour, there'll be something like rolling along in your automobile. And when you get to 90, it's nearer, my God, to thee. They came up with a wonderful idea of a woman driver button, as a matter of fact. It was on the cars last year. I don't know what happened to it. It was a simple button. When you saw a woman driver coming, you pressed it and your car folded up and hid in the bushes till she got out.
Well, I'd like to be able to press a button and a scythe comes out of the weeds, like Bordesier's chariot, you know. And when a roadhog tries to pass you, you could cut him up the bypass, you know.
I saw an amusing, you've got these immense lorries, they call them the juggernauts. On the back, they have long vehicle. And I saw a Mini the other day, on the back it got short vehicle.
And I bet I was driving it.
Yeah, I saw you arriving in your dinky toy earlier today.
I think it would be quite nice if you had a sunshine roof and on your back seat you put a sundial. That would be in case your clock went wrong.
I love to go to the motor show every year because it's nice to see what next year's traffic jam is going to look like. And I always walk down Millionaire's Row because you see all those wonderful Bentleys and Rolls-Royces and Cadillacs and things you can't afford. And there's usually a little pile of Volkswagens in the corner with a card that says, please take one. And the Volkswagen salesman who's saying, I was only taking orders. But what, well, what fascinates me is the fact that at last year's motor show, they said there was going to be an electric car, and I've never heard anything about it ever since. They said it was going to be so cheap you could drive from Glasgow to Southampton for about 10p. Except that the flex was going to cost you £18,000.
That's a good one. Nice one.
Let's turn our attention to Mr. Gregory for a moment. What gadgets would you like on your car, Mr. Gregory?
Well, I think that the basic problem is a lack of communication between drivers. I wonder if the team could suggest any way of communicating with drivers.
You mean, sign language, I know. You do a Harvey Smith. That's as easy as that.
What you need is a silencer in the car to fit over your wife's mouth. That's what you're talking about, isn't it?
No, but you know, he's quite right. It's funny that he should look so ordinary and bring out this brilliant idea, Mr. Gregory. He's quite right. There should be some means of communication as between, like there were in the Air Force, as between pilots of aeroplanes. They could say, look out, I'm turning right, although my indicator says left, and bang, around this.
One of the biggest influences in selling cars these days are the Japanese cars, which are already fitted with all these extras. Little tiny cars like a Honda and Toyota. I met the racing champion of Japan, a fellow called Stachomota, and he... I'm not kidding you. This man is a great man in Japan. He has a big black belt. You know why? Because he's got a big black hernia. That's why he has it. The man has a car, a tiny car, and has every conceivable extra on it. And it is economical because it's so small. In heavy traffic, it runs on the fumes of the other cars. And you don't even have to take it to the car wash. You just park it under a horse and be patient.
Thank you, team, very much. And thank you, Mr. Gregory. Team, here comes a question put to you by Mrs. Beryl Fiddler.
When having a bath, do the team prefer to start by washing the feet and work upwards, or do they begin at the neck and work downwards?
When bathing, do the team prefer to start by washing the feet and working upwards, or do they begin at the neck and work downwards?
With a name like Fiddler, you have the nerve. to ask her this question. Mrs. Fiddler, Mrs. Fiddler, do you have a tiled bathroom? Because I'd love to go on the tiles with you, and then you'd be, then you'd be Mrs. Fiddler on the roof. And that would be lovely.
I'd love to go on the tiles with you, too.
Oh, there!
In the words of the old song, Mrs. Beryl Fiddler, roll out the barrel.
Oh, yes. He's not as good as Elmer Kayam, you know. Anyway, I think it'd be a good idea to start at Centre Point, the navel. Because you get a lot of fluff in your navel, you know. And you're liable to ignore... I found an old set of band parts in mine. You
know? I found an old taken from his script in mine. You know?
Well, I don't have a bath. I just wipe down with an oily rag.
But I'd like to just, if I might, dissect this question of yours, Mrs. Fiddler, because you've missed out the head. You say begin the feet and work upwards, or the neck and work downwards. What about the mush? I always wash my moustache first because it's sacred. I don't want any pollution from other parts of my body to get in there.
Well, I always start at the bottom.
Well, of course.
Because I've always suffered from nappy rash. Since the age of 8.
But I have actually worked it out quite scientifically. You must never wash anything in the remains of something else.
Now, it is funny how different people have ideas of where to start to wash.
What can you
There's
read?
A girl in the flat opposite to me. Now, she always starts at the neck.
How do you know?
Now, what happens after that, I don't know, because the binoculars steam up. Never mind, neck.
I've got an odd ode about a woman who, instead of putting bath crystals in her bath, she puts jelly crystals by mistake. And she sets as in a mould. She has to get the kids from down the road to come and eat her out. And then there are two rather delicious lines. Once she blanched as white as chalk when a boy was careless with his fork. Do you think that'd be a good idea?
The dirtiest man I've ever known is Les Dawson. I was in his house once, and he went off to bed without a wash, and I said, are you going to retire without a bath? And he said, I'm not going to retire for years yet. And his wife keeps a pig in the living room as an air freshener.
That's the wife's sister.
You'll like that.
You'll love that. You'll love that. Yes.
Hey, have you ever had a blanket bath in hospital?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, they start both ends there, you know. Down below and on the top. I know it's a hell of a job to cover your confusion.
What was funny when I was in hospital, there was this timorous knock on the door. And the nurse came in and she took the bedclothes down and she did this and she did that and she did the other and then turned me over and did this, did that and did
the other. What do you mean she did the other?
Then she turned me back again. And I said to her, tell me one thing, nurse. And she said, what? I said, why did you bother to knock?
Nice one, Cyril.
As far as I'm concerned, the whole question is entirely circumscribed.
Oh, be careful. It's a Jewish bath now.
Oh, shut up. It's entirely limited by what I can reach and what I can see.
Jim,
I'll wash anything I can reach and anything I can see within reason.
If you come to a difficult bath, scrub round it.
Mrs. Fiddler, how do you set about it?
Could I tell you about a girlfriend of mine?
Terribly easily.
And her boyfriend called to see her when she was in the bath. So he shouted upstairs and she said, come in, darling, I'll slip on something, be down in a tick. And she slipped on the soap and came down bloody quick.
Well, you know, I've got an odd ode a bit like that.
Oh, you haven't.
Poor little Cleopatra Drane will never seem the same again. One night some little time ago, whilst Ma was at a picture show, thinking she might immerse herself, she took a tin bath from the shelf, and then removing her attire, she bathed before the kitchen fire. Her future might have held some hope had she not trodden on the soap. Looking like nature in the raw, she skidded on the kitchen floor, then finished up this flight so strange by sitting on the kitchen range. Red hot stove, I hate to say, was trademarked in the usual way. Poor Cleo, gazing in the glass, discovered what had come to pass. For where she sat, the poor girl saw, branded the word Excelsior.
Very good, but too long.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time to meet our special guest. Comedian, musician, dancer, you name it, he does it. one of the top figures on the entertainment scene, ladies and gentlemen, Roy Castle.
Rubbish!
Welcome to the programme.
Rubbish!
Never mind the opposition, Roy. Sit down, take courage in both hands and put your question.
What is the worst single heckle that members of the team have ever experienced?
What is the worst single heckle that members of the team have ever experienced?
We're all too modest to admit we've had it. There was the lady vocalist in the old music halls who was doing her best. She was singing her heart out and she was getting the bird terribly. Everyone was booing and hissing her, and a fellow eventually stood up and said, "Shut up! Give the old cow a chance." And she said, "Thank heavens there's one gentleman in the audience."
Well, you wouldn't remember, Roy, but there was a war, do you see?
Oh.
And
oh.
During this war...
Were those zeppelins very big?
Yeah. Well, I don't know much about that one, but in this last one... It was always my great fear that somebody in the audience would say, "Why aren't you in the forces?" Because I registered with the 26s, and I look much younger than that then, because, after all, I only look a child now. So there was this drunken sailor who came up, reeled up to the orchestra rail... in a packed house at Chiswick Empire, and he said, "Why aren't you in the forces?" I found myself saying, "If you come round to the stage door, I'll show you my operation." And it got a round of applause, and he came round to the stage door, and I showed him my operation. We've been friends for years.
The greatest recovery that I've ever heard of a moment that completely interrupted an act, happened to the American comedian Joey Bishop, who was appearing in Las Vegas. And he'd gone out and had just begun to register with the audience when suddenly Marilyn Monroe, the late Marilyn Monroe, looking at her most beautiful, came in at the door. The spotlight swung off Joey Bishop onto her, and she undulated her way down between the tables in a gown that was cut so low you could see her toenail polish.
Funny place to wear toenail polish.
And the entire audience, having had its attention taken off Joey Bishop, the comedian, for 30 seconds, watched her settle. The spotlight swung back to him. There was a long pause, and he said, "I thought I told you to wait in the truck."
Well, I did have it when, during my early days and struggling days in show business, I was doing a rugby cover. It was an all-male audience, anyway. And I started to tell a story, and they said, "We've heard it, we've heard it, we've heard it." So it rather threw me, you see. But I started to collect my senses, and eventually one fellow at the back said, "I haven't heard it, Arthur." So I thought, good for you. I'll tell the story to you. So I started ploughing through this story. It was rather a long one. And as I was just getting to me tag, this same fellow said, "Oh, Arthur, sorry, I have heard it."
Jim, you're the only one so far who hasn't told us what is your worst heckling moment.
They daren't heckle me. They daren't. I'd go down there and destroy them physically. And it's all very well to destroy people with verbal attacks and all the rest of it. I did have an experience. It's relevant because these two ladies in the audience are from Pennsylvania.
And a rebel that never forgets.
I was appearing in the Prince of Wales Theatre, which unfortunately is a sort of catchment for all the polyglot lot that float about London wondering what the hell to do all evening.
The raincoat one.
All the rough and tumble from all over the world come in there. I just made my third entrance in the second act when an American gentleman in the front row stood up and said, "Oh, God, not that guy again." and walked out, and I must confess that I was stumped.
Roy, you've had a few, haven't you?
Well, Roy, what sort of experience have you had in terms of getting heckled?
Well, there's one or two. The worst heckle I used to fear was if anybody shouted, "Get off." That's the one that's got... I never had a reply for.
The worst thing, Mac, is the silent bird. When nobody says anything and you're ploughing away and they start to get up one by one and go out. I had that happen to me a few years ago. Eventually, the whole audience had left, but one man, and he sat there, so I thought, well, if you're going to sit and see it out, I'm going to work to you alone. And I kept on and on. And I said to him, "Are you enjoying it?" He said, "Yes, but don't be too long. I'm waiting to lock up."
Do you have any advice for the team?
Not really, but at this particular occasion, now, one thing that I would do would be this. Now, you've got to say what's that.
What's that, Roy?
That's a word trying to get in edgeways.
All right, Roy Castle, this is your chance.
Okay, yeah, well, the one a fellow once relieved my anxiety about this get-off, because a good reply to that is, I don't do requests. But I had got something to tell you. This last week I worked in a place. There were four Scotsmen turned up into this nightclub, and they confessed to me afterwards that they didn't really want to come and see me because they'd seen me on the telly and they weren't impressed. But they said, we're going away. We're away abroad tomorrow. And we thought we'd better go somewhere where we could drink late. You just happened to be by. And eventually I brought out the bagpipes, you see. One of these fellas stood up at the table and he said, I'll give you £5 if you can play them. So I thought, hello, hello. This is carnival night. I said, £5 if I can play them. And then he stood up and said, to my liking.
So, talking about Scotsman, Roy, you know one of the places that the English comics used to be terrified of was the Empire Glasgow.
Yeah.
On a Saturday night, that was murder. And I was playing there once, and the poor act, the fellow who was on before me, they gave him a most unholy bird. They booed him and hissed him, and eventually he came off, and I went to do my act, and I'd been going very well about a minute, and all of a sudden, they remembered this fellow again and started booing and hissing.
Thank you, team, very much. And thank you, Roy Castle. Thank you very much. And no doubt the first person to answer the next question is bound to be Arthur Askey, because our questioner is Mrs. Sylvia Short.
Have the team got good memories for names and faces? If not, have they any tricks to help them remember things?
Have the team got good memories for names and faces? If not, have they any tricks to help them remember things?
Well, I never remember people, but I often recognise and talk to people that I've never ever met.
I tell you what is a terrible thing about remembering names, and I expect the other members of the panel will vouch for this, is when you're comparing a long show and all of a sudden you think, what the hell is the name of this fellow? He's not very well known, you know. So you say, and now we have... Oh, that reminds me, while you're trying to think of this fellow's name you're going to announce, I find the easy thing to do is say, well, now, ladies and gentlemen, your old favourite, somebody you've heard many times on the radio, and here he is, Mr... and hit the microphone.
The engineer just had his glasses splinter all over his face when you hit that mic.
I usually say things like, who needs no introduction?
Oh, yeah.
But you've got to say the name, Jim. That's the horrible part.
But Arthur, you've got a marvellous memory. You can remember when you were a little fella.
Say Bray. Of course, talking of names, you see, I come from Lancashire, and in Lancashire there's a lot of bottoms. By that I mean there's a lot of people with the name like Higginbottom. As a matter of fact, there was a big convention at the Bolton Town Hall, and all the bottoms in Lancashire were invited by Mr. Higginbottom. And the shuffle bottoms, they shuffled in. The row bottoms, they all stood in rows. The side bottoms stood up against the wall. And the winter bottoms all stood with their backs to the fire.
What did the Rams bottoms do?
They rowed again.
And they waited to make a U-turn.
I'm proud to say Cyril has the greatest memory of any man I've ever known. I haven't seen Cyril for a year, and I walked up today and he said, Bob, I remember you. So I paid him. And I found that while Cyril may not remember every ode he's sent, he does remember every cent he's...
I find the thing to do if you asked... I have this problem, we all have, like you, Mrs. Short. I've got to think of something to remind me of your face. The next time I meet you, I'll know you. and I've got to think what your face reminds me of. And it's very embarrassing, really. I can't think of anything.
Remember the great story about the Indian chief who was supposed to have the greatest memory of all time, and the fellow who was writing the history of Custer went to see the Indian chief, who was 100 years of age, and said, "You knew General Custer, what did he have for breakfast in the morning?" And the Indian chief said, "Eggs." And 10 years later, when he was finishing his book, the same historian went back and saw the Indian, said, "How?" And the Indian said, "Fried."
There were two patients approaching each other in an asylum. And one said, "Good morning, Smithers, how are you?"
"I'm fine, Pettigrew, but my name's not Smithers."
"Well, mine's not Pettigrew either."
"Oh, well, perhaps we're not ourselves today."
My grandfather had the most marvellous memory of any man I ever knew. He's now...
He'll remember my gags, then.
He's in his 90s. I think when you get to your 90s, you get fascinated with names. He's fascinated by the obituaries, and he's always reading them. He always says, "Oh, isn't it marvellous the way people manage to die in alphabetical order?"
Thank you, team, very much, and thank you very much, Mrs. And now, team, here comes a question from Mr. Russell Williams.
Should a vacancy occur for the position of court jester, would members of the team apply, and what joke would they use for their audition?
Should a vacancy occur for the position of court jester, would members of the team apply, and what joke would they use for the audition?
Jester Song at Twilight.
Jester Song at Twilight, or Charlie Jester.
Terrible if you were a jester to King Henry VIII. It would be dangerous, because he was always chopping and changing. And then you might get a job with Queen Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen. I don't know about that, really. I don't really believe that story, do you? Because she loved picnics, you know. She was always uncovering strange parts of Essex. But the... the one I fancy would be Nell Gwynn, period, you know, with Charles I. Well, he said he was
second.
The first. Well,
second.
Was his second.
I'll
it's more likely
you.
Because if he said he was the first, there were quite a few laughing cavaliers who'd say, "No, I was first." But he was second, yes, with Nell. And Canute, he was otherwise known as the Black Prince, because when he was trying to stop the sea coming in, he hit a 4-mile oil slick. And it ruined his costume. But I would love to be the jester who was trusted by his king. Like, do you remember the story about the king who came to the jester and said, I'm going away on the Crusades, and you're the only man I will trust to keep the key of the queen's chastity belt? Because he always put a chastity belt on the queen. With him, it was plunk, click, every trip. And the king rode off. That's awfully nice as an interval. The king rode off to the Crusades, and he was only half a mile down the road when the jester caught up with him and said, "You gave me the wrong key."
Mr. Williams, if you were a crowned head and you had to choose a jester, which of these four gentlemen would you choose as your jester?
Oh, I don't think there's very much to choose between them.
Have you been saying that? I've been saying that for years.
They're all around the same age group, and my grandmother will vouch for that.
The fees are different.
Because they've had the story about the jester who walked into the courtroom one day and the king in his robes was tying his shoelace. So the jester came up behind him and pinched his bottom. So the king turned around and said, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm sorry, sire, I thought it was the queen."
And then the king pinched the jester's bottom, so he was at his wit's end.
Thank you very much. And there, I'm afraid we must close Does the Team Think for today. On behalf of Jimmy Edwards, Arthur Askey, Cyril Fletcher and Bob Monkhouse, and our producer, Edward Taylor, our thanks, of course, to our questioners and, of course, to our special guest, Roy Castle. And if you'd like to ask the team a question, let's hear from you. And we hope you'll all join us again next week. Till then, this is MacDonald Hoadley saying goodbye to you all. Goodbye.